Ahoy, mateys, and welcome to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and attention on the bridge, everyone, it's Captain Pete.
That's Admiral Pete, first mate Matt.
Pete, today we are talking about the pilot episode of the new TNT series, The Last Ship, something that was previewed to us at New York Comic Con all the way back in October. And Pete, why don't we start up with a little summary of the pilot episode? How's that sound?
Yes. We begin in Egypt, and our paleo-microbiologist, Rachel Scott, played by the lovely Rona Mitra, is hot on the heels of a mysterious virus. Later revealed flash forward, because the timing of that scene to me early on was kind of vague. Was this post being on the last ship? Was this pre? Then we have Commander Tom Chandler of the USS Nathan James preparing to set sail out of Norfolk, Virginia, with his first officer, Mike Slattery, played by Adam Baldwin, with Rona Mitra's character in tow, as well as her science pal.
Her science man friend.
Science man friend. Okay. And I would say within 3 minutes, we are at the Arctic Circle of the show. Dr. Scott there is looking for these terns, these birds up in the Arctic. She is also digging up samples buried in the ice. No sooner does this 4 month, passage of time take place, then it's time to break radio silence, head back to the world, only to reveal it's not going to be that easy. Yes. They break radio silence and are told, hey, no, you need to maintain radio silence a little bit longer. Dr. Scott heads back to the glacier or the landmass. It wasn't quite clear what exactly they were on, digging up their stuff again. She wasn't quite busy, or she wasn't quite finished, and this time the Russians in helicopters interrupt them, and thus leads us to put the pieces together that the reason the Russians are there is for some sort of cure. And then we finally get the upshot that over the last 4 months that this USS Nathan James has been incommunicado. The world has been savaged by a deadly virus that approximately 80% of the world's population is infected with. The commanding officer makes contact with the White House bunker, and the president and the vice president are dead, and Speaker of the House lady is now the acting president. And basically, the worst parts of the Bible are taking place all over the world.
And the worst parts of some sort of, Republican view where Nancy Pelosi is now president. That's almost worse than the 80% of the world's population is going to die, at least in some quarters.
Yes. So they're told they need to get to the coast of Carolina to a top secret lab facility with Dr. Scott's potential cure. On the way south, of course, where fuel is suddenly going to be an issue without places to anchor up to and refuel, a nuclear missile streaks overhead and hits either Britain or France. It was never quite clear where it detonated. There is now nuclear fallout drifting their way, and the the blast, the electromagnetic pulse, has knocked out their power temporarily. We get the requisite "why I am a leader" moment from Commander Chandler when he puts the last fuse on the last ship in his hand and holds it in there, to then be followed up by perhaps the biggest cliche on action television right now, the dialogue of "that was badass, sir, that was badass." We then find out this ship is not the last ship. There is another ship, yet this ship is our last ship because this ship can still move. This other, not last ship, second to last ship, an Italian cruise ship, has the fuel and other supplies that the USS Nathan James could potentially use.
I believe that's called a Botus Ex Machina.
Yes, it is. they board it. It's, of course, been ravaged like the rest of the world with this virus. We get the completely predictable somebody's suit opens up, and one of the sailors is infected. And before the debate can fully form over, do we take him back? Do we leave him here? He commits suicide. And that decision is taken away from our characters, at least the rest of them. They offload the fuel and the food. Then they are suddenly very quickly off the coast of Florida, preparing to head 200 miles inland for a... another station they must get to.
I think that was like a research make the cure. Yeah.
There's some internal debate between the captain and the first officer about whether they would be heading to their homes to try to find the remainders of their families. The first officer, of course, having found out that his son has died, but his wife is alive. The captain's family is alive up north, but he makes the command decision that they're going to be pursuing a cure and they're going to stay at sea. And thus, we end our first episode, but not before learning, Matt, that other Dr. Man guy speaks Russian.
He do par Ruski.
Yes.
Just like those bad Ruskies who attacked in the beginning.
Yes.
So, Pete, with the summary so expertly handled by you, what was your initial reaction there of this this first episode entitled Phase 6?
I liked the action quite a bit. You could definitely feel the Michael Bay sensibilities with the explosions and stuff. the pacing certainly as well. Very predictable. I said to my wife as we were watching it, all right, she's digging for a cure. This is before I knew anything about it, that the cure's in the ice, that the birds somehow date back to, ancient diseases and microbes. And what do you know? Spoiler Pete, on the money again.
Well, for my money, I loved this pilot episode. I felt it had very few of the kind of pilot-y moments of like, oh, we need to stop and give everybody's background. I've read somewhere that they're going to get to people's backgrounds during the course of the 10 episodes. But there kind of wasn't that like, hey, he's the new captain. So now he needs to go, are you second in command? What is your name? Let's go see the engine room where they have the engines. There was none of that. We just jumped straight in. I eat up all this Navy stuff, all this military stuff of like, square your jib and listen here, mister, we're going to get through this. Like, I loved this episode. The only thing that I specifically did not like was something that got a giggle when they showed the maybe 90-second commercial for it at New York Comic Con, which is when she's like, when we left, we were at phase 2. And you can just hear the writers like stop typing for a second. They're like, how do we show that things are really bad? Because phase three just sounds like the next thing. And phase four just sounds like you're two steps away.
Let's multiply it.
Yeah. What's three times as worse as phase two?
Guy in the corner, writer's phase assistant six. With a calculator.
Other than that, I loved it. For what it was, and I'm not even trying to belittle it, is this, you know, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones? No, it's not meant to be. Is it summer popcorn stuff? I think it's better than that. It's better than, you know, like, yeah, I don't know. It's better than s'mores because you've had a bad day. To me, this is just a solid military show. Really, really enjoyed it. I'll talk about some of Michael Bay's, or at least what I will assume are Michael Bay's positive influences. Yes, I just said Michael Bay's positive influences. Wow. I'll talk about that in a little bit, but I'm excited for these next 9 episodes.
I mean, listen, I watched 3 show premieres in this case or season premieres last night on TV between the first episode of the 7th season of True Blood, the final season. The first episode of the 4th season of Falling Skies, and this was easily the best hour of television amongst the 3. Now, I don't think that's saying an awful lot. True Blood is not what it used to be. Falling Skies was, you know, a casserole of confusion, and you know, there was this. Like I said, I did dig the action. I do think they've got to show us a little bit more of a hand as far as dialogue. And just like I read, not to parrot, you know, reviews that I checked out briefly before this episode, but these characters, other than the people who play them, are completely forgettable. You know, I can't tell you a character name without looking at the thing here. And, you know, other than Captain McSteamy, guy from Firefly and Independence Day, and Hot Doctor, who's been in other stuff. I can't even tell you the actor's name nor the character's name of, you know, as we've been joking before, male doctor, tag-along guy who is the traitor. No longer on the cast, dead black crewmate, white boy and girl sailor, and apparently not even on our cast list here, Asian sailor who, you know, they talk to once in the mess hall. I think we've got to do a much better job of character. That being said, you know, you've got 9 more episodes to do this. It's a fairly compelling premise. It's not completely without, shall we say, precedent, nor recently without precedent in a show like Ron Moore's Helix, pretty similar in that going in. But, you know, I'm going to stick with it. I know we both have some reservations about where we're going next, which we'll talk about a little later.
Indeed. And for right now, why don't we, we'll stick with the characters here for a little bit. We'll do roll call. I guess I'll start with Commander Tom Chandler, who, based on a military anecdote that I got from Deep Space Nine, I guess there's the tradition that whoever is in charge of a boat, you call captain, regardless of their actual rank. So I guess that avoided them calling him Commander Chandler, which is a bit of a mouthful. To say Captain Chandler just sounds better.
Right.
I dug him as the captain. I mean, he's the captain cut from the same cloth as Adama, as Kirk, as any captain that you've ever seen in anything, in terms of he's the square-jawed good guy who will put himself on the line to save his crew. And you know what? The crew loves him, and he loves the crew.
Yeah, he performed ably here. I found myself going when he showed up asking the doctor, can you synthesize the cure, you know, with his Grey's Anatomy character, waiting for the reveal, like, but wait, I was a doctor at a Seattle hospital, you know, that we were going to go there for a second. I'm interested to see him develop in another role, obviously, other than the one he is most known for to this point. And granted, actors struggle with that type of typecasting. And on top of that, the really kind of mid-aughts Grey's Anatomy cliches of, seriously? Oh, McSteamy? You know, that we're going to be calling this guy Captain McSteamy or Captain McSteamship or, you know, whatever we're going to do here other than his actual name. They need to repeat several times, Captain Chandler, Captain Chandler, Captain Chandler. So we establish some identity for him other than, you know, being a womanizing surgeon or whatever he was on that other show.
I agree with the fact that you're taking the show to task for that, but I don't agree to the degree in which you're doing it. I just feel like, first of all, since this is a ship that's already been in action, again, we're not joining it as, here's the new ensign who needs to be introduced to everybody. You know, there's not an us character there to be the new guy. There's not the Winston Zeddemore. I think within that, it's okay in the first episode, which has a pretty big conflict to sell, you know, global pandemic, and they're, you know, they're the only hope for the species. I was kind of okay with, I mean, you walk away going, as you've said, there's the captain, there's the lady doctor, there's, you know, the man called Jane, who's second in command. There's Master Chief, I'll talk about in a second. There's, you know, some other characters that right now are one note. I feel like I know nothing firsthand about the military. I was not in the military. My dad was in the Air Force for 4 years, way before I was born, and most of his stories involve underage drinking in Las Vegas and throwing up as a result of it. That was interesting bedtime stories, but I digress. I'm kind of okay just saying, like, hey, on this ship, here's kind of the basic command structure. Here's some people that we see in the engine room. Here's some people that we see on the bridge. Here's kind of what they do. I think that was all intentional. Now, again, maybe we talk again at the, you know, at the end of the first season, and say, you know what? We never got to know these people. It's all just cardboard cutouts. But you take somebody like the Master Chief. I found him to be a compelling character. Clearly, you know, top of the boat in terms of the enlisted crew and well respected. He's got the gray in his hair. So he's a man of a certain age. And at a certain point, I was trying to say, I want to just get this guy's name off his uniform, and they weren't framing him that way. So you walk away going, he's the Master Chief. Okay, what do I know about him? He's the Master Chief. And he has this certain demeanor and sense of respect and so on and so forth. Okay, that's okay while we're introducing the conflict and other characters and the particulars and the wonderful set, which wasn't a set that we'll talk about in a bit. I think it was intentional, and I'm okay. If that's their intention for the first episode, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, in uniform for the most part, and, you know, a largely unrecognizable cast, you know, on a second-tier network, it really kind of speaks to the challenge of this type of TV. It's certainly ambitious, but I don't know. You would just wish that we got a little bit more of a character introduction for each that would stick with you. You know, Master Chief for me is guy who salutes captain by asking to salute the captain at the end of the show. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Like, I need more. And we'll get that. You know, they had a lot to do in this pilot. You know, so that's on its way, I'm sure.
With that, Pete, let's move on to our second of three segments, this one entitled In the Navy. Pete, what was your impression here kind of the military aesthetic, the, you know, the orders and the bridge and the engine room and the, you know, the deck and kind of all of that, where they're really trying to sell the reality of the Navy?
I think they definitely portrayed that pretty well. I've been to Norfolk, Virginia. And, you know, other than the overhead shots, you know, we certainly got that feel of being on a battleship. You know, it remains to be seen for me how they're going to sell this each week, given the show's premise, which, you know, could potentially run out of mixed steam. But we'll have to see.
It's a steam ship. Pete, I'm going to go ahead and guess that you've never sat down and listened to the entire commentary track with Michael Bay for Transformers.
No, because I don't want to have to puncture my eardrums.
Well, he talks on there about how he's pretty well regarded within the military.
Yes.
That started with the work he did in Pearl Harbor, and basically how they have a ton of respect for him. And he tells the story in Transformers, and it's a scene that's in the movie where at a certain point, it's when our heroes are still in the desert and they're being chased by the, you know, scorpion transformer thing. They call in an airstrike and they cut to, I think it's a C-10 or whatever the radar planes are. Mm-hmm. And Michael Bay actually said...
An AWAC,
there we go. Michael Bay actually said to the radar commander of that little radar room, like, here's the situation, here's the robot, here's our guys... Tell your people what you would do, because in a certain sense, the military is unconcerned. When the military is meeting up with Hollywood, they're kind of unconcerned. Is it robots? Is it aliens? Is it plague? It's just the military wants to be shown A, in a positive light, and B, in a realistic light. Maybe it's vice versa. Maybe it's not. But basically, that you can go back and watch Transformers, and that guy is a real AWAC military radar commander guy, mm-hmm. giving real orders on what they would actually do if there's this enemy threat that needs to get shot at. So to me, this show, The Last Ship, the fact that it did film on two different destroyers, and Michael Bay's connection, I was aware of that before I watched the show, but I really felt that we really did have grease under our fingernails in the engine room, and that this was all, you know, this all had a certain level of authenticity to it. And Pete, story-wise, I think there were two points where that really kind of came through in terms of, you know, this modern military. Did you notice, Pete, the two people in love, what rank did they have?
I believe they were lieutenants.
They were both lieutenants, which means nobody's... You know, overpowering anybody, certainly to take the joke hat off for a second, you know, the idea of sexual assault in the military is one that's very, you know, very serious. It's a modern issue. It's they're, you know, trying to deal with it, et cetera, et cetera. But this was the way, I think, you know, it's like, hey, the Navy wants to look at your script before you let you on the boat to film. Do sometimes people have interpersonal connections? Yes, that's a fact. However, these two on the show are of equal ranks, and nobody's like, oh, I need to do this because you're my boss. It's the new military. Also, Pete, did you catch the line that Granderson had about old Paris?
I did.
And what was that? Lieutenant Alicia Granderson said what about Paris?
That she had a friend she wanted to stop back and see Paris with.
Pete, I don't think it was just a friend. It was a girlfriend.
And Matt.
I took that as an unambiguous, hey, Lieutenant Granderson, you know, is a lesbian woman. And that's okay. It's the new military. It's just gonna come rolling off her lips that she wanted to go to Paris with her girlfriend, and she's gonna say that to the captain of the boat because you can. It's the new military. Let's stand up and be proud. I think is the Navy's take on all this. This is the policy. We're going to put this forth on this TV show that might have McSteamy and nuclear bombs and killer, you know, microbes. But darn it, we're going to show that there's, you know, we're going to show that there's not sexual assault. While in fact, you know, there is in the military at times. You know, here we have people interacting in a non, you know, or in a completely consensual way. Here we have Granderson who is of a certain orientation, and it's all, they're all effective, you know, members of the crew.
So what does it say then that if this is indeed the case, because I didn't think it was explicit, that now apparently the girlfriend is in a nuclear crater?
Well, I think they're all dealing with loss. That's why we had Mike Slattery was the entire crew, and it's like, I just got the call. My boy is gone.
Yeah, that was really kind of undersold there.
Well, and then, I mean, look, I'm
it's
saying...
more like his boy, you know, left home than he died with the way the emotion. But listen, I know he only had like what 12 episodes of Firefly to perfect his series acting chops. So
I think he was also in a lot of Chuck.
Upchuck?
Just Chuck. But I think that too, because again, I mean, look, as much as I'm praising the fact this really felt like a, you know, in the Navy, I got to be in the Navy for an hour, you know, on my couch. I know that there are, I mean, you know, based on Michael Bay's commentary for Transformers, I know that there are times where, look, there's a give and take. So I think you could have Mike Slattery say, oh, no, man, I got to go down to my cabin and get drunk. I suspect that's something where the Navy would say, no, this is go time. This is like the worst case scenario. We train these people for worst case scenario. He's going to get his character moment is not going to be that he's secretly an alcoholic. It's going to be he gets his butt back up to the bridge and says, I got to do my job right now.
Yeah.
Which again, I don't know what the degree that the Navy is maybe impacting the story, but whatever.
And that to me saved that moment was that, all right, you know, I'm not going to go look at the four walls in my, you know, cabin. I'm going to be on the bridge. You know, that resurrected what was some really tinier, if not dialogue, delivery.
By the way, speaking of the bridge, and what I'm about to say is made all the more easier for the fact that they did film on two ships. By the way, one was the USS Halsey, and I wondered if that's why the dog is named Halsey. But Pete, they had the differentiation between, and they didn't kind of overly sell it or overly point out, you know, like a la the original writer's Bible for Star Trek, you're not going to sit and say, this is a phaser. It is a laser pistol. You're just going to take it out and shoot somebody, and the audience is going to go, oh, it's a gun, like from the future. They had both the bridge, and they also had the Combat Information Center, the CIC,
yes.
Which is more closed in. And if you lose the bridge from a missile or whatever, you can still be doing a ton of stuff from the CIC. So again, they didn't like point it out, but that was clearly the differentiation between the two. So I said earlier, I dig all this military stuff, Navy stuff, Hunt for Red October, the Admiral's putting a pinch of salt into his coffee because that's what you do in the Navy. Like, I eat it all up.
I mean, listen, I certainly, you know, dug that aspect of it. If I were ever in my youth to have chosen one of the military branches, it would have far and away been the Navy, though I am the son of a former Air Force captain, a flight surgeon. But, you know, my grandfather was the captain of both a Dutch merchant marine ship and then later a cruise ship for the Holland America line. So, as you know, Matt, I have the sea in my veins. That being said, you know, though I praised the action before, some of it was just a little over the top. There's no way with those guns they are, you know, quick enough to target helicopters and blow them out of the sky. And then, two, that they could take two direct hits from missiles and just not even blink.
Not even like frost up the window, crack the window.
Nothing.
I mean, I think, to dial back my whole, like, yes, this is so military and I love it. I think it's worth keeping in the back of our minds, as I said earlier, that, you know, their access to Navy stuff and whatnot is coming out of back and forth relationship with the Navy. So, you know, the fact that they're able to fire the helicopter out of the sky so easily, guess what? There's somebody back in Naval Command who's like, hey, 5 million people watched that Last Chip show last night and saw how great the Navy is.
Right.
So there's a little bit of that in there.
And just point of fact, you point out Transformers and going back to Pearl Harbor with Michael Bay might go a little bit deeper than that. Armageddon, I seem to recall, pretty strong, if not just NASA presence, you know, at least an American military presence. So I would say that maybe he seeded that relationship there.
There you go. I mean, again, Michael Bay is easy. He's the low-hanging fruit for a lot of people, myself included, if you like to, you know, if you enjoy great cinema, he's the low-hanging fruit. But the fact that he, I don't know, he does have this relationship with the military, so good for him. Hold on 1 second.
Yeah.
With that, Pete, let's go to our last segment here, Engines Full Speed Ahead. Basically, Pete, what is the potential of this show? I mean, it's a 10-episode first season. It hasn't been sold as a miniseries format. So how long will we tolerate working to find the cure? Will they ever find Earth? Will they ever get back to the Alpha Quadrant? Will the next jump be the one home?
Consider how much of the world they sailed over in this pilot episode for a moment.
That is darn true. From the Arctic Circle to
Florida.
Off the coast of France to off the coast of the Carolinas to Florida.
Yeah. So spread this out over 10 episodes and wow, they're going to circumnavigate the globe. Like I said, I get the premise and it's compelling. I don't think it's a long-lived TV show if just for that. You've got to stay on the ship at sea because, you know, the virus obviously in inland areas. And yes, we saw the previews and they're going to go to beaches and they'll make incursions into different places. And yes, that will help to fill up time and detract from the time that they've got to film on a military vessel. But I just don't know. I've got to see what they're going to do. I could see very easily the next 2, 3, 4 episodes getting very, you know, not tropey, in the sense that, you know, somebody had to get the virus when they went on the ship, on the Italian cruise ship. But, you know, cliche, if you will, you know, we're going to have the episode where somebody brings the virus back. And now it's a threat on the ship. We're going to have, you know, the internal intrigue over the traitor. And then when, you know, we find out, you know, other characters find out that he's doing this. You know, we know the Russians are going to be more involved and that it's a splinter portion of the Russian government and the intrigue that'll go on there, you know. I don't know. I'm hoping for something unpredictable, not in the completely out of left field love-hate relationship I have with another TNT show like, you know, Falling Skies that just went off the reservation last night. But, you know, I'm going to give it a chance. It's summer TV in that, you know, there's a reason this is not holding down ABC's primetime schedule in the fall. That being said, it can still be its own thing and be pretty good.
Yeah, I basically agree with you 100%. I thought that I was kind of excited at the very end where it kind of, it wasn't presenting in a positive way, like, and now the search will continue, but it kind of was that, let's see what's out there, off to the next port, off to the next adventure. It of course is in a very grim sense, but I kind of like that it'll be like, you know, see the world with the Navy, with the last boat in the Navy. I guess we'll see. The next episode or two certainly will be very telling. I think it's
worth
noting.
Well, also completely set up the conflict. Where are we going? Oh, an unmanned refueling station off the coast of Guantanamo Bay. Cue the Cubans and the Russians and, you know, the last Russian ship.
Yeah. Jack Bender of Lost and Alcatraz fame directs not only episode 102, but 103 and 104. Which I feel like is pretty rare to direct that many episodes in a row.
And that gives me a lot of hope. You know, he can't change the material, but, you know, he can jazz it up. He can make the presentation of what might be, you know, some second league writing at this point better. He can help with characterization. So that could be just what the microbiologist doctor ordered.
Well done, Pete. I guess it is worth mentioning we're not going to be podcasting the show every week. Probably the next time we'll talk about it would be, you know, some sort of season finale, if that even warrants it. I mean, maybe it just gets truly awful and we never discuss it again. But I'm looking forward to see where this show goes. I really, really dug it. I've been thinking about it, you know, ever since watching it. So good stuff indeed.
Yep.
I guess with that, Pete, you know, although, you know, because of the virus, it's tough getting messages through. How could people contact you?
Well, 3,660 followers can't be wrong. You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R.
I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost. You can get in touch with the podcast by tweeting at Fantastic Geek. That's fantastic with a P-H. Sending an email to fantasticgeek@gmail.com or leaving a comment on thefantasticgeek.com, which of course doesn't have a the, so it's just fantasticgeek.com. So, Pete, with that, I'm sure that we will talk again soon as this summer of thrills and pop culture adventures continues.
Count on it.
Alrighty. With that, Pete, permission to leave the bridge?
Granted.